Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did America lose with the assassination of James A. Garfield, and how did the 79 agonizing days he clung to life after being shot change the practice of medicine? When the 49-year-old president died just 6 months after taking office, he became a sort of footnote in American history. And that is a great shame, since as my guest today has discovered, this Ohio-born Republican came into the White House with a wealth of experience, a record of reform, and the ideal temperament for building consensus in a country still reeling from the effects of the Civil War. Candace Millard tells the story in her new book, Destiny of the Republic, a tale of madness, medicine, and the murder of a president. Candace, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'll confess, I did not know much about Garfield other than the fact that he died early before reading your book. And over the course of the story, I became a big fan. Can you tell us a little bit about his life before the 1880 GOP convention?
Yes, well, you're not alone in that. And in fact, I didn't know much about Garfield before I began this book, beyond the fact that he was assassinated. But he was an extraordinary man. You know, he was born into extreme poverty and, you know, in a log cabin. He was the last president to be born into a log cabin. I'm talking, you know, oiled paper windows. Mm. And his father died before he was 2 years old. And so to put himself through college, his first year, he was a janitor and a carpenter. But by his second year, he was promoted to professor of literature, mathematics, and ancient languages. Hmm. By the time he was 26, he was a university president. He was an incredible classicist. He knew the entire Aeneid by heart in Latin. And while he was in Congress, he wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem.
Just in his spare time.
Yeah, right. Why not? You know, he was just off the charts brilliant.
So the Republican Party in 1880 was deeply divided. You have the stalwarts on one side, fully committed to protecting the spoils system, and then the more reform-minded half-breeds on the other. And Garfield was a proud half-breed.
He was. He was absolutely so reform-minded. In fact, you know, he was always sort of what he called a radical. Certainly, in his younger years, you know, he was always a fierce abolitionist. He hid a runaway slave. He was a hero for the Union Army in the Civil War, and he always brought that with him. And he was able to sort of hew to his own ideas and ideals because he didn't feverishly want any office, much less the presidency.
And in fact, he went to the 1880 convention with the intention of nominating someone else, John Sherman.
That's right. John Sherman was also from Ohio. He was Secretary of the Treasury under Hayes, William Tecumseh Sherman's younger brother. And he deeply desired the presidency and had for a long time. And he had heard people talking for many years about trying to make Garfield president. Garfield had always dismissed those ideas, but they worried Sherman. And so Sherman thought, well, the smart thing to do might be to have Garfield come to the convention and nominate me. So it would make it very clear who the candidate from Ohio was.
And this very much backfired on John Sherman.
It did. Garfield was an incredibly eloquent speaker, and he went to the convention. It was in Chicago. It was in this huge hall. There were 15,000 people. And the favorite to win by far is Ulysses S. Grant, who's trying for a third term in the White House. And Grant's nomination speech is given first. The entire crowd is crazy, shouting his name. It's raucous and chaotic. And Garfield gives up to give this speech, which is largely extemporaneous. And it is so powerful and so eloquent that the entire hall just becomes hushed, and they're listening to him sort of spellbound. And he says at one point, "And so, gentlemen, I ask you, what do we want?" And someone shouts, "We want Garfield." And the entire hall just goes crazy. And when the balloting begins, delegates begin casting their ballot for Garfield, even though he's not even a candidate. And he objects. He tries to stop what's happening, but it just grows from sort of a trickle to a river to a flood. of votes for him. And before he knows it, he is the Republican nominee for president of the United States.
And the vice presidential nominee comes from the stalwart faction. It's Chester A. Arthur. What kind of relationship did the two men have coming from these two very divided factions of the party?
Well, Chester Arthur was a sort of shallow, preening man. He was a puppet of the leader of the stalwarts, arguably the most powerful and corrupt man in the country, Roscoe Conkling. He was completely his political creation. And so he is thrust on Garfield as a running mate. And he makes his loyalties absolutely clear. Even after the election, he lives with Conkling at times in Washington. He goes on vacations with him. And he takes every opportunity to publicly criticize the president.
So, okay, upon Garfield's nomination, one of his fans turns out to be this deeply unstable man who had the rare ability to fail at just about everything he tried. Can you tell us about, is it Charles Guiteau? Is that how you say his
name? That's right, Charles Guiteau, yeah. Charles was, strangely, he was almost the mirror opposite of Garfield. He also came from sort of humble origins, and he had lost his mother when he was very young. But where Garfield had this incredible success after success, Garfield or Guiteau, as you said, met with failure after failure, and he tried everything, and he failed at everything. He tried law, evangelism, even a free love commune, and he failed even there. The women in the commune nicknamed him Charles Get Out, and so he was mentally ill, and his particular brand of illness was delusion. He had these delusions of grandeur, and so when he reads about Garfield's incredible nomination, this stunning turn of events, he becomes obsessed with him, and this is the height of the spoil system, so he thinks, okay, well, I will single-handedly make Garfield president, and out of gratitude, he will then make me ambassador to France.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing to think that it wasn't like he was trying to be dog catcher. He thought he would have one of the most important diplomatic postings available at the time.
He did, and, you know, this is a time when many Americans believe that they were entitled to government positions, even if they didn't have any credentials. But Guiteau stood out even in this sort of shameless crowd as uniquely audacious. Even Garfield noticed, you know, he would write him letters, and then he started coming to the White House and the State Department every single day, expecting to be given this nomination.
And they understood he was more than just a persistent supporter. They recognized that there was something wrong with him.
They did. Garfield had, you know, there's no Secret Service protection for the president, even 16 years after Lincoln's assassination. But Garfield had this very smart, very able 23-year-old private secretary, Joseph Stanley Brown. And Brown had seen Guiteau, and he was very gracious to him, very kind, but he noticed that he was just, you know, unpredictable and sort of prone to sort of angry outbursts. And so he quietly makes a note, finally, you know, after weeks and weeks and weeks go by, that, you know, he should be kept out. But by that time, Guiteau had sort of fallen to this incredible derangement and desperation, and he has what he believes is a divine inspiration.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute, but let's get back a little bit more into this custom that existed not just for Garfield, but for most of the presidents, I gather, before him. Every day, they had, like, open office hours more generous than what you might find from, like, a college professor in today's United States.
It's incredible. Yes, Garfield was expected to have office, and did have open office hours from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. every day, meeting face-to-face, one-on-one with anybody off the streets who wanted to make their case for a political appointment, and they felt entitled to make it directly to the president himself. He saw about 100 office seekers every day, and it made him desperate. You know, here's a man of thoughts and ideas, and he was just desperate to have time to work. You know, he wondered why anyone would ever want to be president.
So Guiteau, after having been turned down, decides that he's had a vision from God, that God wants him to make Chester Arthur the president.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So he had begun to, you know, follow Garfield carefully, and he finally realizes He has a run-in with the Secretary of State. He's been going to the State Department every day, too. And the Secretary of State, you know, it's incredible, again, to have this, you know, one-on-one meeting outside the building with the Secretary of State, who finally tells him, look, this isn't going to happen. And and Guiteau is angry and hurt, and he goes home, and he has this divine inspiration. And it's really interesting about Guiteau, because he was delusional. He loves the attention that he will later get, and so he gives interviews after interview. He writes an autobiography, and he describes in detail not just what he did, but what he was thinking. And so I know exactly, you know, where he was and how it came to him, this what he, again, believed was a divine inspiration, this message from God that he should kill the president.
It must be really chilling to do that kind of research and to find these documents that say, in his own words, what he was thinking about.
It really is. You know, it's difficult. You know, my last book was about this expedition that Theodore Roosevelt took down an unmapped river in the Amazon, and that was difficult from sort of a logistical point of view. I went to this very remote river. I found this tribe that had haunted Roosevelt and his men. This was difficult sort of from an emotional point of view, because I did come to care for Garfield, and you can see this coming, you can see this happening, and you know, over the distance of 130 years, sort of start to feel desperate to stop it somehow. So at the same time that, you know, it was this great gift as a writer to have all of this insight and all these primary sources, it is absolutely chilling.
Now, if Garfield had wanted guards when he traveled or did something, he certainly could have had them. But the security was not at the top of his concerns at all.
It wasn't. In fact, he said that assassination can no more be guarded against than death by lightning, and it's best not to worry about either. You know, he found these office seekers frustrating and sort of maddening, but not dangerous. He never believed that they were dangerous, and so he all the time would walk around the city by himself. If he wanted to go to the train station, he would just get in a carriage and by himself and just lived his life. In fact, one night he left the White House. He walked down the street to his Secretary of State's house. They walked absolutely alone together through the streets of Washington with Guiteau following them the entire way, holding a loaded gun.
And so they get to this train station, which is located where the National Gallery of Art is today. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then Guiteau essentially is able to fire on him point blank.
He is. So Guiteau, after following Garfield and his Secretary of State and is angry seeing how close they are after he's had this run-in with the Secretary of State, decides the next opportunity he gets, he will take it. And he had read that Garfield was going on a trip and would be at the train station on the morning of July 2nd. And so he arrives there before Garfield, and he just waits. And when Garfield walks into the train station, Guiteau steps out of the shadows and shoots him twice, once in the arm and once in the back.
And how serious were those wounds initially?
They were serious, but they were not fatal. The bullet went into Garfield's back. It did not hit his spinal cord. It did not hit any vital organs, and it went behind his pancreas. And it would eventually incise there. So it's definitely survivable.
My guest this hour is author Candace Millard. We're talking about her new book, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Candace Millard. Her new book is called Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Candace, this story is rich with irony, but the one I cannot get out of my head is this detail. Robert Todd Lincoln, the only surviving son of former President Abraham Lincoln, is serving as Secretary of War to James Garfield. And when he hears that the president has been shot, he insists that one of the doctors who was there at his father's deathbed be the one to take care of Garfield.
That's right. He is at the train station with Garfield and cannot believe what is happening. You know, he later says, "How many hours of sorrow must I spend in this town?" And so he remembers that there's this man, Dr. Willard Bliss. His first name was actually Doctor. And he sends his carriage for him, and Dr. Bliss arrives. But that's the extent of the authority that he gave Dr. Bliss. You know, he called for him, asked for him to come see the president at the train station. But Bliss, unfortunately, sees in this national tragedy an opportunity for fame and power, and he seizes control of the president's medical care. And by the time they get the president back to the White House, he very quickly takes over and dismisses the other doctors. There have been 9 different doctors at the train station, and he dismisses them all, including even Garfield's own personal physician, who was out of town but races back the next morning and finds Bliss saying, "Forget about it. This is my case."
And no one fought back, I suppose, because he just seemed to have this authority?
He did. You know, he took advantage, as you can imagine, with something as unexpected and as horrific as a shooting of a president. There's incredible fear and confusion and chaos. And he was a very confident, very arrogant man. And he just assumed control. And he dictated a letter to the other doctors saying, you know, "The president and I thank you for your efforts, but they'll no longer be necessary." And we find out later that he had never had that conversation with either the president or the first lady.
And in fact, her personal physician insisted on staying on, but was given a sort of servile role.
That's right. She, Lucretia Garfield, had a personal physician who was a female doctor at that time, which, as you can imagine, was very rare. In fact, in the press, they called her Mrs. Dr. Edson because they just weren't sure how to handle it. But she, when to Bliss's annoyance, she insists on staying, and he says, "All right, you can stay, but it will only be, you know, sort of nursing-type duties." But she is there to watch, but she's really helpless.
So you have said, or you've concluded, and based on your research, that had they just sort of left him alone and fed him a little bit when he was hungry and nursed him, he would probably have survived this injury.
He almost certainly would. As I said, this was not a fatal wound, and there were a lot of Civil War veterans walking around with bullets inside of them. In fact, the detective who took Guiteau to the jail had a bullet in his head from the Civil War. But this is a president, and in this case, at least, he was given too much medical care and the wrong kind.
Yeah, to the extent that Bliss and I guess some of the other doctors that came initially were probing his wounds with their bare, dirty hands.
That's right. The first time, in fact, that Garfield is examined, it's on the floor of the train station. If you can imagine a more germ-infested environment, this doctor comes off of the streets of Washington, probably, you know, bits of manure on his hands, and he inserts his finger inside this wound on the floor of the train station. Then they find this horsehair mattress and put him on this mattress, and they take him upstairs, and 8 other doctors examine him. And over the course of more than 2 months, his wound is probed day after day with unsterilized fingers and instruments.
And then eventually they bring him back to the White House, which might surprise people. This was a terrible place to be convalescing, even in the best of circumstances.
It was. President Hayes, who preceded Garfield, had come into the presidency under very sort of controversial conditions, and Congress refused to give him a nickel for renovating the White House, which needed it desperately. You know, the pipes were disintegrating. There's sewage under the house, or actually rats in the house, and there's even talk of tearing it down. It's in such bad shape, and they had planned to give Garfield and his wife money to fix it up, but he had been shot just 4 months into his presidency. So it's preferable to the hospitals at the time, which were overrun and very dangerous from an antiseptic point of view, but not by much.
Well, you say antiseptic. This was like a decade and a half after Joseph Lister had sort of convinced England of the value of sterilizing surgical materials and making sure you walked in with clean hands. Why didn't anybody in charge of Garfield's care follow these standards?
That's right. That's, to me, one of the most difficult to understand aspects of it, because, you know, Lister wasn't just some anybody with some unusual and untested theory. He was a renowned surgeon in England. He had had dramatic results with antisepsis, as you say, you know, a decade and a half before this. It had been widely adopted in Europe. He had come to the United States in 1876 in this huge centennial exhibition in Philadelphia as a keynote speaker for their medical congress for the surgical division, begging doctors here to sterilize their hands and instruments and telling them if they didn't, they ran the very real risk of killing their patients. And he was just dismissed. You know, the older, more experienced, more respected doctors, many of them didn't really believe in germs, and they certainly weren't going to go to all the trouble that antisepsis required to kill them.
So they assumed this was just some fad and it wouldn't last.
Right. They thought it's just another theory, and, you know, I have my way of doing it. Some of them thought, okay, with a wound, I just leave it open to the air or drip tap water on it. And, you know, they proudly talked about a good old surgical stink. You know, they wouldn't change or wash their surgical aprons. They thought the more blood and pus encrusted on them, the more experience it showed. And even those doctors who said that they were trying antisepsis and couldn't figure out why it wasn't working, I mean, today it just seems so obvious. They would sterilize their surgical knives. If they dropped them during surgery, they would just pick them up and continue to use them. Or if they needed both their hands, they would hold the knife in their teeth and then continue to use it.
It sounds so barbaric, but at the time, people were accustomed to this. We have to kind of get our heads in the space of people living in 1881.
They were. I mean, the general person off the streets, absolutely, this was not unusual. But what you have to understand is that it wasn't this untested, brand new theory. I mean, it had been tested and been proven, and so the people in the medical community either knew better or should have.
Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Garfield actually got a letter from a young doctor who said, whatever you do, keep everything clean.
That's right. I actually live in Kansas City, so I'm proud to say there's a doctor in Kansas who wrote to the First Lady telling her, absolutely, you have to stop them first from probing the wound, and secondly, you have to make sure they sterilize everything. And there were also young doctors. There's one young doctor in particular in New York who ends up later writing the first American textbook on antisepsis. And he and his fellow surgeons, young surgeons, were sort of watching in horror, but they don't feel that it's their place to question these more experienced doctors.
So Garfield is getting sicker and sicker. I mean, was he able to carry on any of the business of the presidency while he was ill?
No, not really. You know, he's very much aware of what is going on, but he can't sit up. He's also, you know, he's full of infection. I mean, by the end, you know, he has infection-induced pneumonia in both lungs. He has an abscess that's half a foot in diameter near his liver. He has an abscess on his face that paralyzes his face, and then when it ruptures, it sends so much pus into his mouth and nasal passages that he nearly drowns. He's also at the same time starving to death because he can't keep anything down. The doctors are giving him a gunshot wound victim, rich foods, alcohol, morphine, and he's vomiting and just very ill, and he goes from 210 pounds to 130 pounds. So he's definitely too ill to be acting as president.
And they had really peculiar ways of trying to get nutrition into him, which make absolutely no sense to our modern ears.
They did. You know, they were desperate, and they tried what's called a rectal enema. They tried, you know, all kinds of strange types of milks and things like that that often just made him even more ill. And, in fact, the enemas are they could potentially give him some nutrition, but you have to be very, very careful with them because the drawback is they can also leave you severely dehydrated, which he was anyway from all the blood loss.
How was the country kept apprised of what, at least Bliss said, his condition was every day?
Bliss gave daily and sometimes several times daily medical bulletins, which were sent throughout the country by telegraph and also posted on very large billboards, usually outside of newspaper offices. And the people would gather around. People also just waited, you know, they would sit for hours and days outside of the White House. And that's one of the incredible things about this is that the entire nation was watching, the entire world really watching, and nobody really understood what was happening inside the White House.
I love the little backstory that you actually intended initially to write a book about Alexander Graham Bell and found this little pocket of information about how he spent 2 or 3 months of his life and then realized you had to first tell the story of Garfield. Can you talk about how Alexander Graham Bell was involved in all this?
Right. So Alexander Graham Bell was this young, restless genius. He was only 34 years old at the time. He had invented the telephone just 5 years earlier, but it had grown into this huge company that he hated. He said it fettered him as an inventor, and he was hateful to him at all times. It was also, you know, there were 600 lawsuits against it, and he was spending all of his time fighting these lawsuits and working within the confines of this big company. And so he quit. He had quit the Bell Telephone Company. He had won a prize, the Volta Prize, a French prize. And he used that money to start a laboratory in Washington, D.C. And when Garfield is shot, you know, he's working on all these different projects, and he drops everything he's doing. He turns his life upside down to try to help Garfield because he, you know, as we are 130 years later, was sickened by the thought of these doctors blindly probing for this bullet, and he thought science should be able to do better than that.
And so he begins to work on this invention that would potentially locate the bullet within his body. It's like a metal detector.
That's right. It's called an induction balance. And he had actually invented it several years earlier to try to get rid of the static, basically, in a telephone line. And he remembered, when Garfield was shot, he remembered that it also worked as a metal detector. And so he began working on it night and day. You know, he was one of these people. He would just work obsessively on something. He wouldn't stop to rest or eat. In fact, his parents and his wife were always terrified that he was literally going to work himself to death. And he absolutely did that with this induction balance. He was determined to make this work, and it did work. Unfortunately, he too was defeated by Garfield's own doctors.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Bliss said, okay, go ahead and let's test this thing out, but he would only let him use it on one side of Garfield's body.
That's right. Bliss did two things. One, he didn't tell Bell that Garfield was lying on something that was very unusual at that time, which was a mattress with metal coils, which is, of course, going to affect a metal detector. And then two, Bliss believed and had publicly stated that the bullet was near Garfield's liver on his right side, and so he would only let Bell test the right side of Garfield's body. The bullet was on the left.
Would it have made a difference at that point if they had been able to locate and remove the bullet?
Earlier, it would have, absolutely. What needed to happen is somebody needed to stop these doctors from probing the bullet in the president's back day after day. And because he fought off the initial infection, that infection that he got in the train station and even in the early days, he was doing much better a week, even 2 weeks after the surgery, and everyone believed that he was going to survive. But finally, the continued introduction of infection became too much. And by the time Bell tested twice, and by the time the second test, it was too late. The president, was just so riddled with infection.
There are these really poignant letters that you include in the book from his wife, Lucretia, telling, I guess, friends and family, oh, I think he's getting a little better. This is early on, and I'm so thankful. And those just sort of break your heart because for a while it seemed like there was hope.
That's right. The entire nation really believed that he was going to survive. You know, they had been told, again, Bliss believed that he first believed that the bullet had gone into the president's liver, and he believed that he was going to die, and everyone thought he was going to die that first night. And then when he lived, they're sort of cautiously optimistic, and he got better and better. And so, you know, there had been these people in Ohio who were close to Lucretia who were ready to come to D.C. to mourn with her, and they sort of unpacked their bags, you know, and the governor of Ohio asked the other governors of the country to sort of join with him in a prayer of thanksgiving. And there are all these headlines in the newspapers, you know, about hope and progress and recovery. And then it's almost from one day to the next, he just plummets.
And when Bliss realized that things were not going well, he didn't ask for any other consultations or anything. He just kept everybody out to an even greater extent.
He became more and more desperate. You know, he absolutely isolated the president. He wouldn't even let his Secretary of State see him. He kept him not only in this room but behind a screen. And as the president gets sicker and sicker, he had a few other doctors doing things, even just like taking the temperature. And he took over even those small duties. And he controlled all the bulletins that went out to the people. And he, at one point, he writes on White House stationery to a friend saying, "I can't afford to have him die," underlining each word separately. You know, he had put everything into this, and he had too much at stake.
My guest this hour is author Candace Millard. Her new book is called Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. If you'd like to join us after the break, you can call now 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. With us this hour is author Candace Millard, whose new book is called Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. One thing that is remarkable here, Candace, is that those who were allowed to see the president during his illness reported 2-1 that he was unfailingly courteous, and he tried to put them at their ease when possible, even maintained up until the very end his sense of humor.
He did. You know, he was a remarkably kind man. You know, he had this sort of great personality. He was very outgoing. But people remember even when he was in college, you know, he would always be joking around, but never at the expense of someone's feelings. And that was absolutely true. You know, one of his friends talked about throughout this whole incredible ordeal where he's suffering unimaginably. He never changed. He was always patient and grateful. You know, every time a doctor would come into his, or a nurse would come into his room, he would shake their hand and say, you know, thank you very much. And it saddened him that there was so much sorrow and concern and worry surrounding him, and he always tried to put others at ease. He would, you know, joke with them and trying to reassure them while, you know, he was in so much pain.
At what point did he realize he was going to die?
You know, I think that he too had hope, but when he's starving and incredibly weak. I mean, he can't even read. You know, he was this voracious reader, and his wife had to read to him. And I think he finally realized that he was going to die. You know, interestingly, even though he was this very cheerful and optimistic man, he had long believed that he would die an early death, and he couldn't explain it, but perhaps it had something to do with the fact that his own father had died so early and had left, you know, his wife and children. But he gets to a point where he understands that he's going to die, and he doesn't want to die there. You know, it's not only this decrepit house, but it's in Washington in the middle of summer. It's in July, and it's incredibly hot. It's just miserable, and he knows he can't go all the way home to Ohio, so he wants to go to the sea.
And that scene, the way that he was brought there is just very, very moving. Can you tell us what happened?
Right. So Bliss doesn't want him to go. He's just worried that it'll be too hard on him, but Garfield insists. And so they fix a train car specially for him, an entire train just for him, and they try to cushion it and wrap it so just to protect him as much as they can. And they're taking him to Elberon, New Jersey, and a wealthy New Yorker has offered his home. He has his cottage there, and so these people in the town, they work until dawn. Thousands of people laying tracks so the tracks can take him right to the door of the cottage. And so they travel all along the way. There are Americans lining the tracks, you know, crying, hats in hands, watching as the president goes by. And when they get to this cottage, it's on a hill, and the train can't breach this hill. And out of the crowd of people watching, 200 men step forward, and they pick up this train car, and they take it directly to the door of this cottage.
And it was just a few days later that the same train carried his body back to Washington.
That's right. Now, draped in mourning, again, all, you know, thousands and thousands of people lining the tracks, and takes them into Washington to lie in state. And it's you know, we've forgotten, I think, because he was in office for such a short time, and because it was 130 years ago, that this was a tremendous national tragedy. You know, the American people were devastated, and you know, Garfield was unique in that he was really trusted and respected by the entire country, which was unusual at that time after the Civil War. You know, he was really the first president since the Civil War to be accepted by the South as well as their leader. So he's trusted and loved by North and South, by, you know, pioneers like his parents, by immigrants who sort of saw his rise from poverty, justification for their sacrifices and hope, and by freed slaves and former slave owners. And it was just a devastating loss.
So after he was buried and Chester Arthur became president, well, we should say that the entire time that Garfield was ill affected a sort of change in Arthur.
You know, this is one, to me, was one of the most surprising stories while I was doing this research. I remember turning in the manuscript to my editor saying, you know, I never thought there'd be anything interesting to say about Chester Arthur. But he made this astonishing transformation. You know, he was the puppet and the political creation of a man who was Garfield's stated, self-appointed enemy. And he had, even after the election, had made it perfectly clear where his loyalties lay and had taken every opportunity to publicly criticize the president. But then, when Garfield is shot, Arthur is grief-stricken. He hides himself from public view. He's in New York. He refuses to go to Washington for fear they'll look like he's waiting in the wings. The last thing he wants is for Garfield to die. And amazingly, to me at least, he found moral strength in this incredibly unlikely place, in the letters of this invalid young woman named Julia Sand, who believed in Arthur when nobody else did, when he didn't even believe in himself. And she begins to write to him, and he keeps all of these letters, and he even writes her back. And she says, I mean, she was so eloquent, but I remember she says at one point, she says, I'm writing to you not to ask you to resign, but to do what is more difficult and more brave, reform. And he does. You know, he tries to be the President Garfield would have been had he lived.
What happened to Dr. Bliss after Garfield's death?
Well, there was an autopsy after Garfield's death, and the doctors and everybody else understood right away what had happened. The American people, this autopsy is released, and the American people understand that the president didn't have to die, and they understand why he did. And in every newspaper, every medical journal, Bliss is excoriated, and he's publicly disgraced. But he remains defiant to the last. He adamantly insists that he gave the president not only adequate medical care, but exemplary medical care. In fact, he hands Congress this huge bill for the president's medical care, which they refuse to pay. They give him just a fraction of it. And he, you know, he did. He worked night and day. He lost his health. He lost his practice. And he died just a few years later.
So let's talk about Guiteau, because, you know, Bliss did a lot of things wrong, but he didn't pull the trigger. The man who hanged for Garfield's death was Guiteau.
Yeah, so Charles Guiteau, he mounts an insanity defense. And frankly, you know, if anyone deserved to be found not guilty by reason of insanity, it was Charles Guiteau. He was very clearly insane and had been for a long time and should have been institutionalized long before he was any danger to the president. But the country is so grief-stricken and so enraged that they are determined to see him hanged. And there's a long, long trial. The transcript of the trial is nearly 3,000 pages long, making sure they're covering every aspect of his life. And he is found guilty and sentenced to be executed. And there's an incredible story about him sort of coming to terms with his execution right at the end and asking if he could choose the moment of his death.
And Guiteau was willing for his defense to mount the argument that he was insane, but he said he wasn't insane before the shooting and he wasn't insane after the shooting, but at the moment he pulled out his gun, he was.
That's right. He essentially just didn't want to be executed, but he at the same time didn't want to be perceived as insane. In fact, again, he's incredibly delusional, and so he has big plans for when he thinks Chester Arthur, out of gratitude for making him president, is going to free him, and then the American public will rally around him, and that he himself will run for president. And he's just, you know, incredibly delusional. Even though, you know, people are trying to kill him, he's twice shot at while he's in prison. But he keeps up these delusions until really the day of his execution.
And this was the time, we should remind people, when executions were often public and you could get a ticket to witness one.
That's right. Thousands and thousands of people requested tickets to this execution, and only a few hundred were given. But it took place at this prison, the district jail in Washington, D.C., and there are many people crowded outside waiting for word of his death. And so Guiteau, he wrote a prayer, sort of a poem and a prayer, which he recites on the scaffold. And then the signal is that when he's ready, he'll drop the poem, and he does. And he's hanged, and they open the doors and they let people come in and see him. It's a very different time. Honestly, to me, this is really one of the tragedies of this book, because he was so clearly insane, and he had needed help for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Talk about this. After the autopsy was performed and the results made public and people understood that the reason that their president had died was because of this raging infection that was introduced by his doctor, did doctors look at themselves and say, maybe we ought to consider this antiseptic protocol?
They did, and that's one of the very good things that came out of this incredible tragedy. There was article after article in popular and professional presses, and antisepsis is immediately and widely adopted throughout the country, saving countless lives. And also, you know, Alexander Graham Bell's invention, although he was thwarted by Garfield's doctors, it goes on to save many, many lives in wars before the invention of the medical X-ray and the Boer War and the Sino-Japanese War, and so it too was this sort of medical gift to the country, to the world.
We have an email here from Al in Grapevine who says, I get the sense of chaos surrounding President Garfield's assassination. Is there currently a protocol in place with the Secret Service that covers jurisdiction and medical care of a sitting president?
That's a great question. I don't know. Obviously, it's very different today than it was at that time. You know, just the fact that there was no Secret Service protection at all. And in fact, you know, there wouldn't be, even after two presidential assassinations, it would take another 20 years until McKinley's assassination before presidents started to get Secret Service protection. So I don't know what the medical protocol is today.
Another email from Bill in Dallas, first of all, says he found the book hard to put down. He just finished it and wants to know if your professional association with the National Geographic Society gave you easier access to archival materials in their collection.
I don't think it did. You know, this is one of the wonderful things that I'm not sure people understand is we have, you know, all these incredible archives throughout the country, and really pretty much anybody can go and work in them. You know, I spend most of my time for this book and the last in the presidential papers in the Library of Congress, and all you need to do is bring your driver's license, you get a reader ID card, and you can go. And they're very, very careful. They have lots of rules to follow, as they well should, but anybody can go. You know, there were a few things, like I went to the National Museum of Health and Medicine, where they have actually held in my hand Garfield's spine, the section of his spine where the bullet went, and it was used in the trial. They also have there, in another drawer, just below Garfield's spine, is the remains of both Charles Guiteau and John Wilkes Booth. And they even have a jar full of chunks of Guiteau's brain, which was, his brain was cut up into sections and sent across the country to have it studied to see if you could see physical manifestations of his insanity. But it's all there. Now, that I had to write to them explaining the project I was working on. But besides that, they, you know, I'm sure anybody with a legitimate project could go there, make an appointment, and go there and do research.
Did any of these larger-than-life characters find their way into your dreams during the research and writing process?
They found their way into every aspect of my life. You know, you live with these characters, and I found this was true in my first book as well. For years, you know, for me, it's the research and outlining and writing process is 3 years, and I took them home with me. I was thinking about them while I'm making dinner, putting my kids to bed, driving, you know, all the time, thinking about them, trying to understand them, not just what happened to them, but who they were as people. And you know, what happens is then you miss them when it's all over. You miss them. Even now, you know, it's great to have a chance to talk about them, but I miss that sort of intimacy that I had with them because I, you know, certainly in Garfield's case, I really came to care about him.
The new book by Candace Millard is called Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. Candace, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.